Hello, everybody, and welcome to Elmtown episode 22. Here we are after a bit of a hiatus. I didn't do any shows after ElmConf while I recovered. I just recovered my brain from that experience, which was a wonderful time.
Yeah, and you did a great talk, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Evan. And we're here with Evan. So good introduction. Good surprise.
Hello.
Introduction, Evan. And today we're going to talk about something even related to the talk I gave, which was about ports. But today we're going to talk about how do I write JavaScript in Elm? And that sounds like an interesting title. So more on that after I talk about the sponsors that we have, which are Day One. Day One's the company that I work for. We write a journaling and life archiving app that I love. I think it's beautiful. I put journaling about my family in there. I journal about work. I write notes down from work. I even from the server team when there's stuff that I need to know. In fact, I am the server team as well. I just forgot. But when I need to know server things, I write them down in there and I can come back to them later. Like, how do I get to the server and do these 50 things to make this task happen? You know, so journaling for me is more than just I want to write down cute things that my family said, but also I need to remember things at work. I need to keep track of what I was doing on, I did some important thing today at work. I want to keep track of that. So Day One, I use it for that. So I'm dog fooding it and I hope you would like it too. If you go check it out. And we are releasing Android to the public very soon. I've been saying that for, I think, 7 months, but it actually is happening soon. Things are just...
I can relate.
Yeah, that happens sometimes. Next up, we have Daily Drip. Daily Drip makes keeping up to date on programming skills easy. It's a training service online, and they'll save you a ton of time by providing quality lessons and resources for you right off the bat. Their topics include Elixir, Crystal, that's new. Crystal's a pretty sweet-looking server-side programming language. They'll teach you about React Native, Go, HTML, and, of course, Elm. You can learn faster and more efficiently with Daily Drip, and you can be a better developer. Every weekday, you'll get a short video, about 5 minutes or so, delivered to your inbox. And you can sign up at dailydrip.com and use the coupon code, this is different than before, ELMTOWN-2018. So we're looking to the future, folks. Use ELMTOWN-2018, all lowercase ELMTOWN, and you'll get a 14-day free trial. And Futurus, which is a new breed of innovation consultancy with digital values at its core. We love Futurus. They're sponsoring us because they care about the community and we care about them. They believe in happy people, happy customers, and happy users. And here's a cool shout out. Aussie from Futurus, along with the wonderful volunteer designers that I didn't put their names in front of me, so I will put them in the show notes, just helped us redesign the ElmTOWN website. So ElmTOWN.audio is now available. It's not at the GitHub URL anymore. And the designers redesigned it, and Aussie finished implementing it, and it looks pretty sweet. It looks way better than the little template I had up there before. So big thanks to Aussie and to Futurist too for helping us out with all these things. They are hired people and they do good work. So if you're interested in working for Futurist as well, go ahead and apply to them because they're always looking for excellent people. And they have locations all over Europe. So just give them a call and then they'll help you relocate as well if you are interested in going to live in Europe as well, if you're not in Europe already. Last but not least, we have Ellie, which is the wonderful Elm Live editor that so many of us have benefited from already in the community. It's great for throwing up samples. It's great for making reproducible error cases. It's great for fiddling around. And Luke has done a fantastic job with all the engineering there. It's some pretty really incredible engineering the way it works. And if you want to know more about Ellie, you can go ahead and look at Luke's talk about Ellie from ElmConf and jump over onto YouTube and take a look at that. But thanks to Ellie for sponsoring. And big thanks to Fergus Micklejohn for editing these episodes, producing them. He's always helpful and always making sure that I try to do better than I already am. So thanks to Fergus. And now let's get into the meat of the topic. How do I write JavaScript in Elm? This is a question that lots of newcomers to the language ask because we're coming from JavaScript a lot of times. And there's a lot of flexibility that we're used to in JavaScript. And we get to Elm and we say, whoa, what's with all these limitations? I need to get real work done. I need to call out to use libraries. I need to use these DOM APIs that aren't covered. How do I write JavaScript in Elm? And it can be a source of frustration because it's not always the same pattern that other languages have taken. So it can appear frustrating. But I brought Evan on today to talk a little bit about this because Elm does want you to be productive and there are ways to get these things done. So Evan's going to help us understand a little bit of the why behind the decisions that have been made and a little bit of the how for what to do and when you want to interop with JavaScript, etc. And mainly how you want to get your work done. So Evan, take it away. I'm here to listen and I'll ask you questions, but mostly I want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this topic?
So this is a question that, yeah, like you said, we get it a lot. And I think part of the reason is that a lot of folks, when they look for an alternative to JavaScript, they're looking for like a JavaScript alternative, not a different approach to front-end programming. So there's the answer essentially to like how do you write JavaScript in Elm, it's like there's no direct method, and this sort of, we have to talk about what's the history of Elm, where is Elm going, to really see why there's no direct interop like you have in languages like TypeScript or PureScript or Reason or all these other languages that are more directly, how do we take JavaScript and make it slightly better, as opposed to how do we take programming and use it well for front-ends. So one of the tensions here is people say, hey, like I need this particular tool in that's from JavaScript, and if I could just bring that in, then I'd be good to go. But if you unlock that path, right, so there's a lot of things that people would want to bring in from JavaScript world. So we'd probably end up with jQuery, D3, a time library. And the thing is, like, all these libraries are designed with JavaScript surface syntax in mind. Like, how do we make this feel good in language with objects, with mutation, with like chaining with dots? And when you try to put a functional interface just on top of that, ends up being unfortunate. So an example of that is D3. So that's something where a good friend of mine tried porting D3 to Elm early on, and figuring out exactly how to put a type, like types, on the way that library works is extremely difficult. And so that was kind of exploring this direction of like, what if there are some cases where there should be things that are implemented in JavaScript? And the end result just like wasn't a very fun or easy to use library. And so in that particular case, we didn't end up introducing that, but rather decided to go, hey, I think if the community works on making a way to do data visualizations in Elm, we'll end up with something that's competitive and possibly better. So in the, this is definitely a longer path. Like we could have gotten T3 in some level of quality a long time ago. But instead we said, okay, let's do it better in Elm. And we end up with libraries like Elmplot that say, hey, SVG, that's just a view function. And then we can make these really nice plots just saying, here's what I want on screen. And then if you want to animate that, that's sort of separated from how do we get SVG to move around. And so that clean separation of animation and view wouldn't have happened at all had we gone with D3, and we end up with a library where it's very simple. You can have animation or not. So there, this is one aspect of it, is like you end up with these libraries that are sort of tailored for what Elm is rather than what JavaScript is. But this is sort of like a surface level thing that I think some people are aware of, but I want to get into sort of the deeper reasons for this.
Yeah, because I think some people say, well, that's nice. I mean, I love that, but I have to get work X done today and library Y, and Elm doesn't exist. So what do I do?
Right. So the short answer is like ports are the way to go for that. And if ports can't work for you, then Elm isn't going to be the right choice for you. So we can get into ports later, but I want to focus on what are the constraints on allowing people to write arbitrary JavaScript? Like, why is that risky? But above and beyond, like, hey, libraries come out in a nice way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay.
One is portability, right? So when I write a package, or when anybody writes a package and uploads it to package.elmlang.org, it's just Elm code. So that gives us some guarantees, which is cool, right? So we know all the guarantees of Elm are guarantees that the package has. But if we think about the future of this language 10 years, 20 years down the line, it doesn't seem obvious to me at all that JavaScript will be a healthy language used by like happily by people, right? In the sense that the web is moving towards WebAssembly, and that's going to give us an opportunity to optimize things quite a lot more than JavaScript is able to. And a lot of people are like really love Elm, and they're interested in seeing it on different platforms. They're like, man, I really would like to see Elm on servers. I'd really like to see it on iOS. I'd really like to see it on Android. And so if we just let people write arbitrary JavaScript code in the Elm ecosystem, that means the Elm ecosystem is tied to JavaScript. And so when we're compiling to iOS, let's say, we've limited ourselves on performance, which is one of the most important things on that platform. And the language itself is designed so that we can do some really cool stuff with performance. And maybe it will be helpful to just like talk about some of those things that we can do. So one example, there's a language called Milton, M-L-T-O-N. It's very cool. It's basically standard ML. And they made a compiler for it that's called a monomorphizing compiler. And what it does is it takes all the functions in your whole program and anything with a type variable, so like identity goes from A to A or map goes A, whatever, it finds all the call sites and specializes them to the concrete type that'll be used. So if you're mapping over a list and it goes from ints to strings, all those types will get specialized. Now, once you've done that for the whole program, you can optimize the data representation, right? So instead of saying there's a generic way to say this is a linked list, you say, well, this is actually a linked list of integers. So rather than having a pointer to a boxed integer, I just put the integer directly where the pointer would have been, and I save myself an indirection and two extra memory locations.
And this is all at compile time.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Right. And if you have like an array of floats, again, you can just say, I'm just going to allocate C-style arrays where it's just floats in a chunk. So there's no extra overhead at all. And so when you start doing these kinds of things, like this project was a research project, but it got these extraordinary results of the binaries are smaller, the code is faster, garbage collection happens way less often because you're just producing less garbage because you're getting rid of all these unnecessary indirections. There's all sorts of tricks you can do when you start having that level of specificity. Now, imagine that we could have that kind of analysis for the whole ecosystem of Elm or a bunch of huge, widely used libraries were actually JavaScript code. And so not only do we get JavaScript performance, but we have JavaScript like foreign function interface conversions from whatever is in JavaScript to this like densely packed efficient representation in Elm. So it's just like, I personally think it'd be extraordinarily sad if the language ended up not being able to go down those roads for the short-term gain of like, man, I really want this particular JavaScript library today. Right? Because like, if Elm is going to be on servers, going to be on iOS, these are serious projects, right? So I think about this from the perspective of like, I've been working on it for the web for about five years. And that's not primarily like, hey, I'm making a compiler, that takes a little time. It's, hey, I'm making a language that's good for a particular domain. So in my mind, when I say, hey, like, can we have Elm run on servers? To me, that's a five-year process. And if I'm going to spend 5 years of my life on something, I want it to be something that's like should exist, right? So like if I spend those 5 years and at the end it's like, yeah, I mean, but really you should just use Scala. It's like, that's not how I want my life to go.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So because it doesn't sound like a big ask, like, oh, it should just run on servers, no problem. So it might be interesting to get into a little. Well, there's another digression here about like how to think about how Elm should run on servers. So I was talking to someone about Elm for like shell scripting, and my perspective on it was like, first, we have to know how to interface a functional language with databases. Then we have to design like how servers should work knowing that information. And then shell scripting is really a special case of a server where rather than reacting to inputs all the time, you just don't have those hooked up and you just run some task. And so to me, designing how shell scripting should work requires first understanding how databases integrate with a functional typed functional language in a good way. And if you have that whole set of problems integrated in a nice way, it's going to be like beautiful. It's going to be amazing. But if you go the other way from shell to server to database, like everything's going to feel like a hack on some other thing before. So like there's this idea of like, well, we can just take the gradual path and end up at the right place. And I don't see it that way.
Well, partially because there are already plenty of languages that have done that, right? I mean, there are languages solving those problems in their own general purpose way. And I don't really see a whole lot of reason to just do that same thing again.
Yeah.
And that's part of the value I find in Elm is I feel like Elm tells a compelling and a cohesive story about how to write applications for the front end. And not just because like it's a neat language, but I mean, I could do that in Haskell and get a similar experience. I mean, different, but similar. But it doesn't tell a story to me about how to do it that's as easy or cohesive or directed. And yeah. So that's where I feel like there's a lot of value in the Elm world.
And I really feel that. So my servers are written in Haskell just because the compiler's written in Haskell. It's kind of interop is nice with the compiler if you do that. And I'm often just like confused about why they're presenting me certain choices that don't seem to be viable choices for a server. So it's like all the things you need are there, but like that doesn't mean that I end up writing a good server.
Right, yeah.
And like that's what I have my eye on, not writing servers in Elm, in the same way that it's not writing JavaScript in Elm. So one is this portability that I think with WebAssembly, with different platforms, like once we are able to get some of that going, it's going to be totally obvious why this is a valuable thing.
Makes sense.
So another example of this revealing the value was we would always say, hey, like it's not a good idea to have functions in your messages. And people would be like, yeah, whatever. But when the debugger came out, and for us to store the history, it's actually impossible to have functions in your messages. It has to be only values that can be serialized.
Right.
And then people are like, oh, yeah, we should never use functions in our messages. So that the reasoning was true before and after, but like it was revealed in a very obvious way that doesn't require like a lot of communication. So that's when this will get a lot clearer, but I want to emphasize this now. So another thing that's important about keeping the JavaScript part, so there are parts of the Elm ecosystem that do need to interop with JavaScript. So if we want to use the browser's HTTP library hooking up to the DOM, we have to talk to JavaScript. So the idea is that that code should be as small as possible. So I'm going to be
small meaning that there's the least amount of it possible, right?
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, so it's not like, oh, it should all be like minified, but just right. Like, yeah, it shouldn't be, well, the way it's set up is in the next version of Elm, it's going to be called kernel code, and it's going to be specifically available to the Elmling organization and an organization called Elm Experiments, or I forget exactly what that one's called. The idea being that if the set of libraries that have kernel operations are controlled by Elm, if we want to move to a different platform, like those are the only libraries that have to get new sort of interop backends to whatever the language happens to be.
Which is pretty exciting because the idea of being able to bump one version change, you know, maybe make some API changes, upgrade your own project from version X to version Y, and all of a sudden be running on WebAssembly with much higher performance. Like, that's awesome, because the cost has already been paid by the language designers and not by your company having to do a bunch of crazy refactoring in order to be able to run on a new, faster platform.
Right. And this also ties into why some of the API design takes longer than people would expect. Because, like, if someone's like, hey, I want sort of like something like storage or files in the browser, I don't look at it as, how do we take what the browser gives us and just directly copy that into Elm? I think, what's a way of thinking of storage that will work on phones, servers, such that that API will make sense and be implementable in this 20, 30 years of future work?
Right, yeah.
So, like, the idea of a file system that just, like, crashes when you get to 10 megabytes doesn't seem like the right choice for a server, you know?
Right. Definitely.
So, by keeping this small, that has these... So this is getting at the portability part, but there's also a performance aspect, even without any changes to the compilation target. So one of the things that not many people know is that over the last couple releases, I've changed how this kernel code works pretty dramatically. And one of the cool things is that because it's kept only for Elmlang, no one knows that, and yet their code gets a ton faster or minifies a lot better. And it's just like, oh, neat. And this
is except for the people who have gone to write it themselves and, like, reverse engineered and now have a bunch of work to do to try to change it. Yeah.
Yeah. But right. For people who are, like, using the language in the... But using the public APIs of the language only, that's how I say
right.
it.
So that's what I mean. That's a great reason to not go out and reverse engineer and dive in as often as possible so you can get free wins. It just makes financial sense, too, to try to stick with the public APIs, right?
Well, and, like, like some people say, oh, well, it's an undocumented API. It's not a public interface. Like, it's an undocumented implementation detail. So, like, and the reason it's undocumented is because it's, like, in the same way that I don't have a big document on, like, here's how to do, like, type inference extensions. It's like, right. That's not a thing. Right? And so, like, people are like, hey, you need to document that the thing that's not a thing isn't a thing.
Okay, yes. Right.
And it's just, I've never been in a situation before where it's quite like that. I mean, it makes sense what the confusion is. But at some point, I was just like, how do I document a thing that doesn't exist doesn't exist?
So yeah. I think I got you off track a little bit. You were talking about the big performance wins of just refactoring
sure.
this stuff.
Yeah. So this is actually something that's relevant to my ongoing work for 19 is I'm changing how... essentially how code is generated by the compiler such that you can get smaller assets.
Super cool.
And it's like, I'm very excited about it. I've learned a lot about how to get things very small. And one of the things is like all the code that's in Elmlang, like, it's just different now. It doesn't work the same way to allow these kinds of optimizations. So for people who are using the public APIs of the language, like ports and like the libraries and all that kind of stuff, when they upgrade to 19, it's just going to be like, oh, great, like my assets are tiny now. Like, and I didn't really have to, like, the core logic of my thing didn't change at all. I'm not rewriting tons and tons of JavaScript code or something like that.
Love it. Super cool.
Now, if the whole ecosystem is tied to, like, has a public JavaScript API or like foreign function interface, the way that was designed in, let's say, like, I don't know when they introduced ports, but like 3 years ago, would be the way that we always do it, right? And like, I just didn't get it right then, you know. That was part of why we made the decision then as well, is like to think that this is the right code gen for even just the JavaScript compilation target was, I don't know, it was sort of naive in a way where, like, I know it's naive, but I don't know what the other thing is. Does that make sense?
I think you lost me a little bit there. I lost the contrasting point that you were saying. You said that when you released ports a few years ago, if you had known that the current CodeGen was going to be better, that's where I got a little
the
lost.
The idea being, like, CodeGen worked in a certain way at that time. And when you do foreign function interface, it has to sort of be aware of how the code looks and how you're going to interface with that generated code. And that means what does the data look like? What's the representation of a list? What's the representation of an array? And those like fine details are actually really important if you want a really fast interrupt. So a thing that is actually really important when you have foreign function interfaces like the more like traditional direct ones where it's just like, I'm going to call this C function. I'm going to call this Java function.
Right.
If you're doing the port conversion that we do, that becomes really, really problematic because the way you end up writing your code is there are these calls to a different language peppered in there. So if you have a different data representation, doing those conversions is going to be a huge cost. Now, because we're doing ports, it's not like a single function that has 10 foreign function calls. It's you go out to JavaScript, do a bunch of work, and then come back. So what would have been possibly hundreds of conversions is now two.
Yeah, the ports API that you have to consider as a language designer is very small, right? I mean, you've said there's a way to get in, a way to get out, and we support like JSON, and that's it right now.
Well, and like the crucial thing is like I was talking to some folks who were working or like interested in Reason ML, and they were wondering how do you get the ports messages conversions to be really fast. And the answer is kind of like, I've never heard from someone who had where that was their bottleneck.
Right.
Which that the question was even asked suggests that it will be the bottleneck in this other design, right? And that makes sense if you're going to have an Elm function that's got 10 foreign function calls in it and you're going to call that function 100 times.
Right.
That's a lot of conversion between Elm data structures and JavaScript data structures. And that's just not how it's the interrupt is structured in the language. So that's sort of like a lot of the technical points, right? We have portability, we have the ability to improve performance and size of the compiled code, and we have the sort of overall ecosystem reliability, right? And getting these APIs that, like, I've gotten to see some of the, well, I don't want to put pressure on this other. I've gotten to see some upcoming APIs, and I'm super excited about how these libraries are going to look in comparison to the JavaScript ones. Because it's really, what does it mean to solve this problem in a good way, as opposed to what does it mean to take JavaScript ideas and implement them in Elm?
So you mean you've seen upcoming APIs from package authors?
Yeah.
Are super neat? Okay.
Yeah, I'll do a decent amount of pairing with people and looking through just to see how things are going and give advice if people want it. So I'll get to see some upcoming stuff, and it's just like it's super cool.
Is that upcoming stuff because the package authors are being innovative, or upcoming because 19 enables features for them to do new stuff?
It's unrelated to 19, yeah.
Okay, cool.
It's just like they're, yeah.
Just innovative ways of solving the problem instead of replicating an existing API, for example.
Yeah. Cool. And I don't want to, I apologize for not being so specific, but like one of the things that is really stressful as a library author is like when you have something really cool and people know it's cool, it's a lot more stressful.
Yeah, that makes sense. Instead of saying, hey, look what I did.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you finally like release the thing, people are like, finally,
Yeah.
As opposed to, wow, this is really cool, you know?
Happens to Apple every time they try to release a new product. What? Just one new iPhone? Yeah.
So given there's all these sort of technical reasons that go back into historical choices in Elm and into like the next 10 or 20 years of what's going to be happening in Elm. So that's a constraint we have. Now, if that's something that for your particular problem or business, like you can't do that, there are a couple options. One is to use ports. And in my opinion, this can cover a huge amount of what people need. But I think it's like, I've not done a good job communicating the intended use, right? And like Murphy's talk, your talk revealed that to me. Okay. In that, like, it didn't occur to me because kernel code, writing JavaScript in Elm, is so sort of not within the vision of the language, and like all this like years of planning that I'm working on, I don't see things from that perspective very easily. And so I didn't see ports from that perspective very easily either. So your talk was really helpful for me in sort of underlining that the docs on ports didn't really give people what they were looking for, okay, or the background they needed. And that's part of why I wanted to talk about this kind of stuff. Let's get into that, right? So
okay, great.
One of the things that I really want to emphasize in writing after 19 comes out is how to get going with ports, right? So when someone searches, I want to use local storage in Elm, I want the first thing that pops up to be a blog post about doing it with ports. And I think it's, if you do things in the way that ports were intended for, that can be quite nice. And that's just like not intuitive, and it's not what people are expecting. And so I think a lot of frustration comes from that. Like, whatever the expectations are, it is slightly different, and there's no like on-ramp to those different expectations. So this was similar to when we had people were like, how do I write a single page app in Elm? And from my perspective, it was just like, well, you just write it. It's like, there's no problem. And other people were like, I don't think Elm can even do it. Like, do we need to introduce objects or what people will call components, things with local state and methods, and you instantiate them. And what happened was not that Elm changed, but rather that Richard released the single page app example. Richard and I both did talks at Elm Europe about how to structure larger Elm code bases. And that worry of like Elm is bad at single page apps became like, oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
And nothing changed, just like more documentation became available that understood both where people were coming from and like how to get them to how it works in Elm. And so I think with ports, we're at the point now where it's like where we were with single page apps a while back, where it's like we know that there's this confusion or like expectations that don't match up, but there's not that path to using things in a good way.
I think that an analogy that might work here is like, let's say you're constructing a house or something and you want to put a couple of boards together and you're used to using a hammer and nails, and then someone comes along and they hand you a like an air-powered nail gun, and you like start to try to hit the nail with the gun, and you're like, this sucks. I cannot get this nail in straight with this gun, right? But it turns out all you have to do
this
is
big
like,
compressor. Like, what's
right.
The point of that?
Yeah. But then it's like, hey, you just actually put the gun against the wood and pull the trigger, and you get your goal done in a different way. But I mean, like, it shouldn't be a hammer. It's not a hammer. It's a nail gun. And that's kind of how I feel about ports versus FFI as well. Is like, a lot of us are expecting to come find the Elm hammer, and there's this nail gun sitting there instead. And it's like, it sucks because I can't hit it on nails and have it work, you know?
And I don't want it to sound like it should be obvious, right? Like, a nail gun is like a thing people are familiar with. So like,
yeah,
I
that's
want
true.
The tool to be like some weird thing that you just look at and you're like, that's dumb. You know
yeah,
what I mean?
Right.
So I don't want to give the sense that like it should be like, oh, if only, I don't know. I think it can sound kind of like elitist or condescending to put it in with the wrong analogy.
Maybe
but
like an
there's 1800s some weird
can opener or something instead. Like, yeah. You're like, what on earth? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So my,
or like a loom or sewing machine.
Yeah.
Anyway, go ahead. Stuff that I have no idea how to operate.
Yeah. So what I'd like to do after 19 is out, is I'm going to write more about sort of the kernel code stuff that I've been talking a lot about so far. And I hope that will be a good resource for the community that will help us grow these kinds of documents. But in the meantime, I really want to focus on my like implementation work and less on writing about this stuff, which is legitimately like it's very difficult to see where people are coming from and really understand that place and then write the path with examples that are concrete and helpful and engaging.
Right.
And make it something that people find on Google when they just search, like, how do I do this enough?
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. And so my hope is that folks in the community who sort of feel like they see how ports can work well can help out and sort of start creating that scaffolding. And one of the things I've noticed is that, certain resources are like considered more authoritative. So I think ultimately like having the nice path and the guide is the way to go. But in the meantime, I think these things will be really valuable and I can learn from how people are presenting it and what seems to work for people. Because that's something that like in talking with Richard a lot, he has a really great way of relating and teaching people from a JavaScript background. And so he'll see these like bumps on the learning curve that I wouldn't see otherwise and finds ways of presenting things in just the right order to smooth that out. And that's been really helpful to me just because like I can learn from his insights. So I think there's a really cool opportunity there to help see where we can go with ports. And I also have a feeling that once we start exploring that more, it'll be clearer, like, what would it look like to make a JavaScript library that's meant for port interop?
Yeah.
Does that make sense, right?
Yes,
so, like,
it does.
What does a local storage library look like that's intended to, there's one port saying, here's what should be stored, and there's one port saying, here's what is stored, whatever the actual design is.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And then, from that perspective, it's like, you can install things with NPM or whatever, and you still have this nice interruptory rather than saying, how do I write a JavaScript library and then publish it to the Elm package repository? Right? So like, I think there's something here, but again, like I can't explore that as deeply as I'd like and work on 19 at the level that I'd like. So
yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So docs for ports is something that we can look forward to in the future.
I mean, for me, long term, yes. But what I'm saying is, like, in the interim, I need help.
So is that a call to action for those who use them, who understand well?
Yeah, for people who feel like, you know, I found a way to use ports that really works for me. Like, I think this is something that just, like, people say, this sucks, and then they're mad. Or people get it, and then they're like, oh, this is fine. And so there's just, like, this divide where we just, like, don't talk to each other across that. And I think it would be really, really valuable to do that.
Well, it sounds like it's also a call to action that for all of those who are confused by ports and not understanding how they're useful to not feel bad about asking. Because it seems like there are a lot of people who are confused about it. You should get on Slack and ask or maybe write a blog post about the things you don't understand and ask for help. And that's okay because you're not the only one, right?
Well, yeah. And in this case, it's specifically like people on Slack can help, but the truth of like how most people learn languages is they just like don't talk to anybody.
Yeah, that's true.
Right. So like the things that are high on the Google search results for the things people think they need is how you learn a language. So that Slack is a resource that's available, it's great, but like I really think in this particular instance, it's not enough to... Well, one way to put it is like there's going to be more work on Slack if we don't have these blog posts.
Yes, yeah, because we got to repeat things and go over them again. Right.
So one of the things that I think surprises people about this idea of ports is it won't work for everyone necessarily, right? So there may be something where you really like you get the trade-offs that are made to go with the ports approach, and you're just like, what's a good example of this is, let's say you have an interpreter for a bunch of different programming languages, and they all need to interact with each other in a nice way. You may not even want a typed language for that, right? Let alone one that restricts interact with JavaScript. And so like there exist problems that it may just be a difficult choice. And I think it's also important, given that, to sort of help people find the tool that's the best fit for their like worldview, right? So in my opinion, this design will work for the vast majority of problems. But for some people, it's like they don't want it to work that way, right? Yeah. So yeah, it could, but like it's not interesting to me. And so right. I think it's important to sort of see these languages as tools for achieving your goals. And so I don't think like people in Elm, people outside of Elm should be afraid of saying, hey, like it looks like this other language might be a good fit for how you want to approach this problem. And
yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
One of the things I've noticed is that like sometimes when people say that, people just assume that we're being like disingenuous, right? Like how could like Evan or someone think that some other language would be a better tool for the problem that I have? Like, is that, surely he thinks his thing would be the best, or, and that's like not how I look at the language. Like it's not like what's good is dependent on like the goals that you have.
Right.
And so like for some people, for some, just like taste in how you think a language should be, like other languages are going to be a better choice. And I hope people can feel comfortable saying that, and it doesn't sound like disingenuous, like a lie or like a insult or something.
Or like you're sending them away and like saying, don't be part of the club, because there's no club. Like it's not.
Yeah, that's something that really, I personally, like when I see someone say, oh, like what are Elm programmers called, like Elmos or Elmers, and I'm just like, there's no name for this.
You shouldn't base your identity on the tool that you use,
right? And so like from my perspective, it's like the things I've learned from using Lisps, from using typed imperative languages, from using untyped, like that's all really valuable to me. And I think to myself as an Elm programmer, as a functional programmer, it's really, I feel, limiting. So anyway, that's kind of a digression, but I think we shouldn't be afraid to say like, right. And this comes back to something I said in the code is the easy part talk about like, when you have a healthy programming ecosystem, you have different languages that embody different values and different design decisions, and the communities like self-select towards affinity to those values, right? So
right.
You have Python and Ruby, and like the values that are embodied, like that are revealed in the design of the language and the character of the community, are very different. But if you look at the two languages next to each other, like from a programming language's perspective, they're not very different. And like having those two places of very different philosophies, I think is really, really valuable. So and that kind of ties into the ports documentation. It's like, okay, like for some people, this isn't what you want. And so just like check out these other options, because that might be what you're looking for, you know? And you don't want to waste people's time if it's not going to be what they want.
And I really feel like the benefit of Elm and any other language is probably to serve the making of the product that you're trying to make and the business needs of the business that you're trying to form or support, etc. And so actually when I'm talking to people about this too, and they're asking about Elm and trying to figure out if Elm is the right choice, one of the things that I tend to ask or say to them to think about is, well, it really depends on your engineering team, because if you are all interested in, excited by, and motivated by Elm, you're going to be able to do your product, you're going to, like, it's capable of doing that. You can do it and you can be happy with it. But if you are all not excited about it and don't want to do it, or just one of you is excited, it's not going to work, because it's, you're talking about preference and being the right tool too. Like, you have to, you can make it work in many ways, because we do this with all the tools that we use. Because of some appreciation for some features, we deal with less convenient parts of using language in other ways. And so, so what I try to tell people is that, A, you know, like, if you want to use it, then try to use it and it's going to work for you. But B, use it for what it makes sense for, because there's a lot of pain in trying to make Elm or any other language do a bunch of stuff that it's not built or designed to do. So probably just use that other tool for that other thing and make them work together.
Yeah. So it's like, some folks will say, hey, I need a language that works on both the server and the client. And I'm just like, oh, like, Elm isn't that language.
Yeah.
Right? And I think what's tough about that is that folks really like to use Elm for front-end stuff, right? And so it's kind of like, it's kind of sad to think, well, you know, with a couple hacks, like, this could be possible. And it's just like, I come back to, what's the 20 years down the line impact of just a couple hacks? And it's immense, right? So I try to, like, when I talk with people about this stuff, I try to say, like, the one possibility is, like, it just isn't the right tool. And I kind of wish more people would say that about technologies, but...
Part of it is, like, it isn't the right tool for you, but maybe what you're saying is, if this is a point that is non-negotiable for you, for example, the same language on the server and the client, if this is a non-negotiable point, then this isn't the right language to solve that problem. But maybe if you sit back and maybe consider that point as negotiable, maybe you'll find that that's an acceptable trade-off, and that actually not having the same language on the server and the client is worth it, because the Elm is really good at client stuff, you know? So maybe maybe questioning the assumptions of what is negotiable and not will change whether it's the appropriate tool to solve the problem for you or not.
And I think this ties into a thing that I'll get when I'm talking about these kinds of topics is like, didn't you say, let's be mainstream in that talk a couple years ago? Like, if you really want to be mainstream, wouldn't you want the onboarding path to be as smooth as possible? So I want to talk about this because the context of that talk, let's be mainstream, is actually really important. So that was at a conference that was 50% academics and 50% like people who do functional programming, type functional programming. And this was quite a few years ago, like 3 or 4 years ago. I don't remember exactly. 2 years? I don't know. There was no Facebook language that was typed functional, right? Like, it wasn't such a thing then. So when I say let's, I'm talking to a room full of academics and functional programmers. I'm not talking to the whole world. And when I say mainstream, like, oatmeal is mainstream, but that doesn't mean that every single person eats oatmeal for every single meal.
Yes, right.
Right, like, it's just though. Like, yeah, but it's just like a normal thing. Like, it's a normal choice that people can make. So the goal isn't like world domination or like programming world domination or whatever. It's like, I have had these experiences with type functional programs that I think, like, the feeling of solving problems in this way is just incredible. And I wanted more people to have access to that. Or, like, I just was so excited about it that I just wanted to work on it.
I really like that rebranding, though. Let's be oatmeal. That's good.
That's kind of been, like, one of the early, like, taglines was, like, I want, like, making web development, like, pleasant. I'm not sure if that was the right word, but it's, like, kind of a low bar, right? Or, like, the feeling of when you're sitting on a train and then periodically you look at it and you're like, oh, it's look at it. It's a nice field out there. It's nice. Like, that kind of relationship. Not like, oh, it's amazing. But, like, maybe we could get to that level of, like, riding a train. That's fine.
I like it.
But so that's one piece, and I think that's something that actually explains a lot of the design process around Elm. Is like, I'm not trying to like maximize growth or maximize GitHub stars or maximize like Twitter followers. And that's also something that's like I realized is actually a cultural difference coming from JavaScript world, because a lot of I went to a conference that was had a lot of JavaScript folks, and people like their relationship with their project was like related to how many stars it had on GitHub.
Interesting. It's a popularity contest in a way.
Well, but just like, oh, this, it's not that, it's not a like super important project. It's only got like 3,000 stars, which is like a weird relationship to a project, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, what that really is measuring is like, did it get on Hacker News? Like, did a designer do a nice logo? Like, it's measuring a lot of very weird things. And so I think people come to Elm and they expect that same value system to be guiding the core development process. And it's just not, like, I'm not looking for stars. I'm not looking for, you know, 90% market share or 89% so we don't trigger monopoly laws or whatever, you know?
Sure, yeah.
So I think people find that confusing. And so once you recontextualize it as, how can we make an ecosystem that's going to be nice for 20 years? Like, a lot of these choices make sense. And so an example of specifically making choices that hurt adoption are the syntax of Elm. Like, had we chosen something that looked more curly bracy,
right,
that first moment of like, oh, gross, or oh, weird, I think a lot of people have that, and they're just like, eh, this is weird, and they leave. Or like putting commas at the beginning of lines. Like, oh, this is weird, I'm out.
Syntactic walls of... Yeah.
Yeah, and so like I'm aware that that happens, but that was a cost that I wanted to pay, because I think when you look at Elm as a language on its own, like the syntax choices make sense, right? So you do have this bump at the beginning, but once you're over it, it's this other world that's really pleasant, right? So like curly braces are just for records, not right, for tons of other stuff as well. And like that clarity would be lost, I think, if you tried to say, how do we make C-style syntax like just work in this other system? So, and you see other communities that don't have the same value system, right? So when you look at ReasonML, my understanding is they just did a new release that makes the syntax much more like ES6.
Okay. Yeah, and I think like, that's right, but I haven't looked deeply into it myself.
I just looked a bit. And so like that is a manifestation of values that just like I don't relate to, right? Like the goal isn't the fastest possible growth curve to the maximum number of people.
Right.
So, right. Like it's how do we make a good thing that in 20 years we look back and say, yeah, it's still good. Like it didn't devolve over time.
So we're almost out of time, but I wanted to bring something up, and I don't really know where it fits in or how to do a transition to it. So this is my transition.
Okay.
saying that, but when I started first learning Elm, I was coming from trying to learn Haskell, and started to learn Elm, and it immediately made a lot of sense. I was able to do stuff really quickly, but I still felt like I wasn't a real programmer until I learned Haskell and PureScript. And like, I mean, not that that was a fact, but that's what, while I was doing Elm stuff, I was like, oh, but if I really understood things and if I really wanted to be serious and professional, I'd be doing PureScript or writing in Haskell and compiling to the browser, etc. So I did learn PureScript, and I wrote a bunch of stuff in PureScript, and it was a lot of fun and it was pretty neat. But what I discovered from that experience was that the pragmatic choice for making web applications for me at that time was actually using Elm. And not that I was like, I ended up not feeling like I was stepping down, which I had previously felt like, oh, if you're just getting started, you use Elm, and then once you understand things, you use the power of PureScript. And I'm not knocking down PureScript, because I think it's awesome too. It's just it's a different approach. But I mean, I was in both places, and I think they're both really cool. And I saw and made the choice that the Elm was the right tool for the job. And so I think that maybe that perception is still a thing for lots of people who are starting to look at Elm as like, oh, is this just a way? Is this a path to seriousness? And are these? Is this just a place where people do toy projects and like learn about functional? Do you see that in the
community?
Yeah, so
that I made a note about this. There's like a ambient narrative in the culture around Elm that's like Elm is for beginners, right? Like it's designed to be like welcoming to beginners and like tools that like real experts need aren't in the language. And I think that's just like that's the manifestation of a particular perspective in the sense that like from my perspective, I want a simple language. And it right. happens that a simple language is also good for beginners, right? So like it appeals to me that the error, it appears to me personally that the error messages are really nice.
Right.
It also happens to be true that beginners benefit hugely from that, right? But like for my case, like I'm working on a compiler all day and like I get error messages that like don't help me. And that makes it hard to do like a parser or type inference. So I think there's the root of this perception is the ideology that these the more complex language features are necessary in the language, whereas like the thing that I'm trying to say with Elm is like the parts that you need are actually a lot simpler, right? There are these language features that can introduce complexity to the language into your code, but I think you can solve those problems with a simpler set of tools and you end up with simpler code in the end. So it's not, this is designed for like learning or for kids or whatever. Like it's like, I like simplicity as a design goal. And a side effect of that is that beginners enjoy that.
And I think that being friendly to beginners is not the same as being for beginners.
Right. Yeah. And so this is something that like you have to be very careful of with programming languages. Is if you're collectively perceived as a teaching language, people won't consider it for serious stuff. Right.
Yeah.
So a good example of this is Python, like, because it's such a simple language, it's excellent for teaching and like is now like lots and lots of schools in the United States are switching to using Python to introduce people to programming. And
instead
that's
of
not,
very simple C++, right?
Well, yeah. And it's not because like, oh, we're hiding the true complexity of C++. It's like, this is a simple language on purpose because we value simplicity and
right.
that is a good tool for teaching people as well.
Yeah.
So I look at Python as a sort of like, I really respect how that community has grown over time and how it's sort of become very diverse in the sense of like, there are people who are learning programming, there are people writing servers, there are people who are scientists who are doing data analysis, there's people who are social scientists. It's a really vibrant ecosystem, and that's something that I kind of want to push towards. And I think simplicity in the language is part of why they're able to bring in people from different disciplines and get that richness. And so so does that kind of answer the thing? Like
it
frustrates me when people say, oh, Elm is for beginners, and I'm like, it's just simple, like
right.
that
that makes a lot of sense. And my analogical brain is reaching for all kinds of analogies that I won't share right now because they are on the spot. But I'm sure that we can all think of our own analogies as to why that would apply. So I think we are almost out of time, but do you have any last notes, Evan, stuff that you may have not fit in that you want to fit in right now?
I think that's everything. And I just want to end by going through like the big points here. It's like one is like the reason to avoid kernel code for everyone is portability, performance, size, guarantees in the ecosystem, all things that are like really important to the long-term health of the language. And that in the meantime, before we get the documentation sorted out in the guide, like people who are knowledgeable in the community, like it would be, I think, hugely helpful to the community to start writing about this kind of stuff in blog posts specifically. Because like a podcast, like I can talk to sort of engaged people in the community, but it doesn't reach like top Google search. I'm going to listen to a 50-minute, whatever, however long this is, podcast.
Yes.
But yeah.
Makes a lot of sense. So let's, to wrap up, I didn't ask you to prepare for this, but I think it would be cool for each of us to recommend a resource to better use Elm. And so I'll start off by saying that I started listening recently or watching the screencasts from Elm Seeds, and I'll link that in. That's just a show about how to use Elm libraries and languages that is put up for free, and it's really got some super neat stuff in there. So I'll link to it in the show notes, Elm Seeds, and that has helped me already, and I've watched a number of the videos. They're nice and short and pretty helpful. But off the top of your head, Evan, do you have like a package, you know, to recommend that people can learn from and use, or some kind of learning resource, something like that?
I'm going to say they should watch your Elmcom talk.
Oh, I'm so flattered. I'm so flattered.
Yeah, I really think that's like an important step forward in this kind of discussion. That's been one of the big sort of community conflicts, at least on like sort of more intense community platforms for developers and stuff.
Well, and now, of course, I wish I could give it again, because like the day after I gave it and put it on YouTube, people gave me feedback, and I totally realized that I had conflated a few points and ideas in a confusing way, and I was just going, oh no, wish I could give it again right now. But maybe it'll be useful as is to people anyway.
Yeah, I think so.
Well, thanks. I'm very flattered. All right.
Are there picks? I have a pick.
Oh, yeah, please.
I've been watching tons of Adam Curtis documentaries, and he has one called Century of Self, and he has a movie recently called Hypernormalization, and they're very interesting documentaries.
Do you want to pick all of them or just those two?
I'm gonna pick all of them.
Okay.
those two are good starting points.
What made you like them particularly?
He's trying to understand how the world ended up where it is today by looking back at the last century of politics and culture and marketing and all these kinds of things and how they fit together. And it's an interesting perspective. And in the case of Hypernormalization, he's got this like style of like the font is terrible and it's the wrong color, but it's like what it needs to be.
Okay.
I don't know if that makes sense. I think it's the title screen even. When you see it, you'll be like, okay, I see what is happening here.
So. Okay, yeah. Well, very cool. So I think we've done it.
Cool.
So until next time, thank you for listening, everybody. Evan, thanks for taking the time to come and talk. I really appreciate it.
Of course, thank you.
All right, bye.